83. Tonight, partly cloudy and 59. Saturday, sunny and 83. Sunday, sunny and 76. Monday, Labor Day, sunny and 72. Right now, some light rain in the area, 72 degrees Kenosha, 71 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today, and they all concern books intended for young readers. One brand new interview right at the outset, and then two interviews from the archives, actually recorded earlier this year. Here's part one. And for the next few minutes of the WGTD Morning Show, I'm excited to be speaking with a tremendously gifted and prolific writer by the name of Samuel Satin. And he will be particularly familiar to you if you are acquainted with the world of graphic novels, anime, manga. He has quite a number of best-selling works to his credit, including Buzzing, Side Quest, The Silent End. He's adapted Wolfwalker's Song of the Sea, The Secrets of the Kells. And he has made some headlines in this field with a new project that has just been released to the world, Unico Awakening. And this marks, in a sense, a reinvention of a beloved character created by one of the great giants of this world, Osamu Tezuka. Unico Awakening has just been published by Scholastic, and this is the first venture of Scholastic Publishing into the world of manga. And this is a big release, being released in 12 different languages. And it all got off to an interesting start, and we're going to be talking about that as well. Samuel Satin, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hey, Greg, thank you so much for having me.
I have a feeling that, unlike some of the interviews you've done with very specialized programs that are very much rooted in this world, we talk about everything on the Morning Show, and I'm sure there are listeners who probably have only a very tenuous idea of what manga even is. Just for a moment, can you introduce a newcomer to what this world in general sort of looks like, resembles?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So basically, manga is just the Japanese word for comics. And so essentially, we're talking about comics as a whole. But manga, because it comes from Japan and it has its own stylistic and story kind of qualities, we see it as a little bit different and kind of stands out among a lot of modern graphic novels and Western graphic novels. So that's basically, it's basically just a different kind of way of telling stories through comics.
I think that one of the most intriguing things about manga in general, and I'm by no means an expert, but I've explored it a little bit, is that sometimes at a glance, one can really get kind of the wrong idea about sort of the tone or color of manga. Because at a glance, visually, it looks really, really cute. I mean, to the point of being even cutesy. Yeah. But in fact, behind that cute veneer are often stories that can be incredibly dark and painful and mature. And I suppose for somebody just getting introduced to manga, it's important to kind of understand this aspect of it.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right, because, the different kinds of manga run the gamut. American comics are kind of catching up a little bit in this regard, but manga, there's so many genres and so many different kinds of books. There are books for people who want to read about sports. There are books for people who want to read about cooking. There are adventure stories. There are dark stories. There are cute stories. And there are ones that kind of combine the two, like you're saying. Some of the really popular series in the United States right now, for example, that came over from Japan, like Attack on Titan, for example, or Demon Slayer, they do look really, really cute, especially Demon Slayer. But, you can't hand that too young of a kid because it can be a little bit, the themes can be a little heavier, even though it does look like it could be for a younger audience. So, you do have kind of run into that kind of conundrum sometimes where you have to think, okay, who is this book for?
Right.
And it depends on kind of what culture you're in, because here we have more of a understanding of what books should be for what, age group. But it does pose an issue sometimes especially for parents looking for books for kids and going to the library, and the kids want to read manga, and then they pick up a book and the book is far too above their age grade.
Exactly. So this particular project that we're talking about today, Unico Awakening, marks an adaption of a very, very beloved character by one of the great giants of this field, Osamu Tezuka, who's been gone a long time. I think he died in the late 1980s. But sometimes he is thought of as the Japanese Walt Disney, which probably doesn't even maybe do full justice to exactly who he is. But it gives some sense of just what a towering figure he is. Tell our listeners a little bit more about him and then how it is that you've come to be able to take one of his characters and give it new life.
Yeah, absolutely. So Osamu Tezuka is considered in Japan and by a lot of people who read manga around the world to be the god of manga. And this is because he essentially created the modern manga and anime industries. He was so prolific. He made all kinds of work, spanning from kids' work to adult work, and one of his, he's also the creator, as many of you might know, of Astro Boy, for example. And so his work made it the world over, and Unico was one of his iconic characters that came from a trip he took to Los Angeles in 1976. And he tried to introduce manga to a kind of U.S. readership. And at the time, he was maybe a little bit ahead of his time. So it was drawn kind of like a storybook, almost like a lush Disney storybook. And and unlike traditional manga, he illustrated it from left to right. And so when I had the chance to basically interact with Tezuka Productions, which is the company that's his modern kind of ward, I decided that, they said that, you can give us a pitch. And so I went over a lot of different characters that I thought I could maybe work with, but Unico's story was so unique. And I thought that it really had the capacity to reach a new generation of readers. And I thought that, and because Tezuka himself so believed in the art of collaboration and sharing stories, I pitched an idea to Tezuka Productions, and they accepted it. And from there, we embarked on a large Kickstarter campaign, and eventually towards this larger series with Scholastic.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the heart of this story in terms of Unico, this sweet-natured unicorn who attracts the wrath of the goddess Venus. And we don't often think about the goddess Venus. I mean, in most mythologies, Venus is the goddess of love. And we often think of her, maybe mistakenly, as a mostly benign figure. She's certainly not that in the story of Unico. Tell us more about that.
Right. So, yeah, Venus in this story, and also through the lens of Tezuka's original work, is a goddess who is the goddess of love and beauty, but who over time became envious of anybody else who could challenge her sway over human beings. There's a larger backstory that's kind of forming around her in Unico, in the new Unico series. But essentially she is a once great goddess of love and beauty who's been kind of corrupted by her own sense of jealousy and want for power. So Unico, for example, who is this creature who's able to spread kindness and love just kind of naturally through the type of creature that he is. He inspires people. He's this beautiful unicorn. And because of this, Venus becomes enraged and wants to have him destroyed. And so one of her servants, this god called the West Wind, takes pity on Unico and hides him from Venus. But in order to do so, she has to wipe his memory so he'll forget who he was. Because once his powers awaken, he draws her eye again, draws Venus's eye again. So it becomes kind of this chase through space and time in which Venus is trying to capture and destroy Unico because he interferes with her ability to inspire human beings.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. What did it feel like to be, in a sense, sort of treading on sacred ground? I mean, taking a character that is so well known in this world and wanting to do something maybe a bit new with it, yet remaining true to its long legacy. I mean, that ends up being, seems to me, a very intriguing artistic conundrum.
Yeah, I suppose what I can say is that I do it with a lot of respect in mind and with a lot of thoughtfulness and also in collaboration with Tezuka Productions in Japan. So I work very closely with Tezuka Productions and the artist team, who's incredibly brilliantly talented. They're called Gurihiru. They're a team of two women who live in Saitama, Japan. It's a collaborative project with them as well. And so, this is a cross-cultural collaboration in which we work together to create a story that both homages the original material and creates something new, with the thankful blessing of Tezuka Productions, which keeps and they really enjoy the direction of this project. And the great thing about Osamu Tezuka himself was that he believed that comics and manga were an international language. And so he believed that they could be used to cross cultural boundaries. And he also loved the idea of collaboration. So he once saw a poster of the movie of Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And without even seeing the movie, he went and created his own version of Metropolis, which became a very beloved story in Japan and the world over. So, he believed in this spirit of collaboration and inspiration and retelling. And so we're kind of doing it in that spirit as well. And hopefully he would be pleased with what we've come up with.
If you have time, I'd love to have you explain this matter of left to right. You just kind of mentioned that very quickly in passing, but for someone not as immersed in this world as you are, they might not even quite catch what you're talking about there.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So most manga is read, first of all, there's two things about manga. Most of it is that it's all usually in a grayscale, so it's always black and white for the most part, and usually it's read from right to left. That's what usually manga is, the order in which manga is read. So that's the opposite from the way that we read in the West. But Tezuka originally created Unigo to be read left to right, as like in the same style as a Western book, and he made it in full color. So it's kind of unique in the manga world, and we've adapted it as such, so it's a full-color book that reads left to right, and it's lushly illustrated and beautifully colored.
So from the start, this was perhaps designed to be maybe more approachable by Western readers. Is that fair to say?
For sure, absolutely. It was actually created to be to try to get young readers in the West to get into manga. But it was a little bit ahead of its time because this was in the 70s when it came out. And so, but what we're doing now is because we're kind of creating a story for younger readers. So Unigo is a story, though everybody can enjoy Unigo, and we've heard a lot of people who do, who are adults and kids alike. Its primary demographic is from 8 to 12. So what I was saying earlier is about a parent going to a store and their kid wanting manga and looking at something like Demon Slayer and thinking, oh, I want that, and they realize it's very bloody or very, a little bit ahead of their age group. This is something that that a kid can read that still contains the hallmarks of manga, but is more age appropriate and more accessible.
And as we mentioned earlier, Scholastic is releasing this in 12 languages, and that must be so exciting for you.
Oh, God, it's an absolute dream come true.
Again, this is Unico Awakening, and it's, I'm guessing, maybe the first of perhaps even more such works around this beloved manga character, published by Scholastic. And Samuel Satin, the author. Samuel Satin, it was great to meet you and to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Best wishes on all of your future creative endeavors.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was a wonderful question.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about an incredibly important book. A book really intended for young readers, and yet I am not ashamed to say that I learned a tremendous amount from reading this book called Made in Asian America, A History for Young People. This is a book that seeks to, in a sense, set the record straight, to fill in many of the gaps in our collective education when it comes to the presence of Asians in America, and the contributions that they have made to our life, and the kind of terrible racism which they have faced over the course of many, many decades. It is a story most of us who are, in a sense, white Americans, if you will, know very, very little about. I know that I find myself shamefully unaware of so many details about the history of Asian Americans. So I am grateful to have had the chance to read this book published by Quill Tree Books. The two women responsible for it are Erica Lee, who is a historian, author, and teaches at Harvard University and has written a number of books, including The Making of Asian America and America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. The other author, Christina Suntornvat, is someone who is a three-time Newbery Honor recipient. Her works include All 13, The Incredible Cave Rescue of the Thai Boys Soccer Team. And she has actually over 20 books she has written for young readers. This one, again, titled Made in Asian America, A History for Young People. Erica Lee and Christina Suntornvat, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to have you. Good to be here.
I am so grateful that this book has been written and is available. I think it is incredibly important. And as I said at the outset, even though you intended it for young readers, it is something that I think a whole lot of people, even if you're 63 years old like I am, should be reading and would learn a lot from. Tell us about the challenge of telling this story so completely and yet with the intention of it being a book to connect with young readers. What kind of a challenge was that for the two of you?
Greg, this is Erica, and I'll start and then let Christina fill in some of the gaps. But thank you again so much for reading the book and for your review. I think that we couldn't have asked for a better review. It's certainly a history for young people, but I know, like you, there are many, many adults who are interested in this history as well and who are waiting for a book like this, not just for their own kids and their students, but honestly for themselves. But yes, you're right. It was an incredible challenge to write a book about Asian American history. We cover 400 years, and Asian Americans are an extremely diverse population. Fastest growing group in the United States, make up 7% of the current population, but represent folks from all across East and South and Southeast Asia with roots back to those countries, and really diverse stories. So that was one of the biggest challenges, is what threads to pull out of those histories to share with all of our readers, young and slightly older. And so I think we've done a good job talking about American history through the lens of Asian Americans. You touched on some of those themes already, racism, xenophobia, but it's also a story of migration and taking chances and pushing for and securing equal rights, not only for Asian Americans, but for all Americans.
So this is Christina. I'll just add that we knew from the outset that making history relevant and interesting for kids was going to be a big challenge for us, and we knew that we could easily overwhelm them with dates and events and lists and timelines. And so the way that we decided to tell this history was through the stories of real people. And wherever we could, we chose to highlight real teens, real young people, kids and teenagers, and tell the events in history through their eyes. So that's how the book is structured, is through personal narratives. You get to know these people who are kids just like kids living today. And I think that's going to be an effective way to reach our readers.
The book is incredibly timely as well. And of course, it is being published and released at a time when the whole issue of immigration and the immigrants among us is in the headlines all the time, and often in really disturbing fashion. Did you write intentionally and structure the book intentionally to make it timely, or is it just on its own a very timely book for the times in which we find ourselves right now?
This is Erica again, and I'll start with an answer and then let Christina follow up if she wishes. It's a great question, and you're absolutely right that we Americans are reading news about immigration every day, and again, sometimes in really disturbing ways. And in many ways, of course, the book is timely and does seek to shed some light on the history and current conditions of immigrants, whether they be of Asian descent or not. But in other ways, it's a timeless story, because this is a history, and American history is one of immigration and also migration. And so we hope that readers will get a sense of some of the past conflicts that the United States has engaged in over immigration, but also the resilience of immigrants and their descendants. Christina and I are both descendants of immigrants, and so these are personal stories. In fact, some of our family histories are part of this book. And we hope that we can humanize the story of immigration for all readers in a way that adds some empathy and humanity back into some of the disturbing headlines.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things why we need to know history, is to notice patterns and notice trends that are coming up and popping up again. I remember several years ago seeing Japanese Americans whose families have been incarcerated during World War II showing up to protest about the detention of immigrants and the separation of immigrant families at the border. And they held signs that said, never again, because they didn't want to see what had happened to their own families here decades later happening yet again. And the vilification of immigrants, whether they're Asian American or, you know, any immigrant at all. So I think that this is the power of learning history, is taking action when you see something happening that's happened before.
At one point in the book, you take a few moments to talk about the term Oriental. And I am old enough to remember a time when that term was used very freely with, in a sense, clear conscience. And of course, now that term, we understand its, in a sense, its implications so much better than we once did. Explain why, even for young readers, you think it's important to take a moment to talk about this particular words and other issues related to language.
That's a wonderful question, and this is Erica. My parents, second-generation Chinese Americans, grew up being known only as Orientals, and so it really is within our lifetime that that term and label has been used, and I think in many parts of the country it is still used rather than Asian American. And one of the wonderful chapters in our book describes just how that the term Asian American came to be. And it was part of the 1960s, social protest movements, when peoples of Asian descent, Americans of Asian descent, were getting tired of being called by a term that they had not chosen, and a term that was used in really derogatory ways. And for them, it was really important to not be seen as Oriental, as something from someone from the Orient, a distant and exotic but kind of uncivilized, barbaric land, which is the ways in which that term was used throughout the 19th and early 20th century, but rather in a way that rooted them in the United States as Americans, but of Asian descent. And so in the 1960s, there became a term to self-name themselves as Asian Americans, Americans of Asian descent.
I really appreciate the fact that your book takes such a long view. I mean, going all the way back to the era of slavery and pointing out the far more significant place of Asian slaves on the North American continent than I think most of us ever realize. And, of course, trace much of the history, including points of time when the discrimination was sort of rampant across the board. And at other times when we were more, in a sense, selective with our bigotry, for instance, during the Second World War, when it was okay to befriend the Chinese, but the Japanese, of course, Japanese Americans were viewed with grave suspicion. And so the way in which this bigotry is played out over our country's history is also something that you probe with a lot of detail, and I appreciate that. I want to just give each of you a chance to pick out one of the people that you focus on in the book. I mean, stories of resilient, gifted, young Asian Americans. I'll give each of you a chance to kind of choose one to give our listeners a sense of what this book is about.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, I'll go first. One of my favorite people that we profiled was the Olympian Sunisa Lee. So if you remember, just very recently in the 2020 Olympics, she won the gymnastics women's all-around gold medal. And that was an incredible event, historic event. She was also the first Hmong Olympian ever. And you know, her story is incredible for so many reasons, but I just remember watching the Olympics before even knowing I was going to work on this book, and seeing her huge Hmong family watching and cheering along in a room filled with people, and, you know, reading about, you know, listening to interviews with her talk about how much pride she felt, also pressure that she felt as, you know, someone who's carrying a lot of the hopes and dreams of people who came to the United States mostly as refugees after the wars in Southeast Asia. So she, her story is an example of how we lead into talking about the United States' role in those wars in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, and the lasting impact that it's had on the people in that region, and then the people who came to the United States and began shaping the, you know, United States in their ways, including being these Olympic heroes like Suni Lee.
Very good.
And this is Erica, and the young people that are inspiring this book are a group of middle school and high school students who I interviewed in 2021 who were making headlines. They were protesting and advocating for the inclusion of Asian American history and studies in their classrooms in New Jersey. And I called them up and talked with them each and learned their stories and learned how they felt that they were forced to learn Asian American history and a lot of other parts of American history on their own. It wasn't in their classrooms, wasn't in their library books. And during the pandemic, they were harassed and verbally abused and felt that one of the answers to fight anti-Asian racism and racism in general was more education, and in particular, more education about Asian Americans. So they lobbied in the state of New Jersey. They joined with other students across the country that include Asian American history as a graduation requirement.
Great stories. Those are just two of many wonderful stories in this fascinating, illuminating book titled Made in Asian America, A History for Young People, published by Quill Tree Books. It includes fascinating rare photographs. The co-authors, Erica Lee and Christina Suntonvat, thank you so much for giving the world this really important book. I hope many people will take the opportunity to explore it and learn from it. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about a marvelously crafted new novel intended for young readers titled Louder Than Words. It is a collaboration between New York Times bestselling author Ashley Woodfolk and acclaimed actress Lexi Underwood. In the novel, we meet a young woman by the name of Jordan Jones, who, as the novel begins, is still reeling from having been unfairly expelled from the private school which she was attending. She finds herself a student in a public school for the first time and trying to figure out who she wants to be, how she wants to fit in, and what kind of difference she wants to make. Jordan is, at her heart, a young activist. And one of the themes that the novel touches on is what that means to be a young activist in the 21st century. It's a beautiful book about friendship, how important friendship is. It's also a book about keeping secrets, about trying to leave behind things that we have done wrong in our past. It's about having second chances, a chance to remake ourselves. The book is also about social media and what a destructive force it can be in people's lives, especially young people's lives, when it is wielded as a weapon. And it is also a book about art and how art can be an amazing tool for the young activist. Ashley Woodfolk, one of the co-authors, has been working in children's publishing for over a decade, and her previous books include The Beauty That Remains, When You Were Everything, and Blackout. Her co-author, Lexi Underwood, is an acclaimed actress, probably best known for her marvelous breakout performance in the wonderful miniseries Little Fires Everywhere. Lexi Underwood has gone on to create her own production company called Ultimate Dreamer Productions. This book, Louder Than Words, is published by Scholastic Press. So my first question to the two of you is how the two of you met and how you came to want to collaborate on writing a book together.
Sure. So this is Ashley. I'll answer that one. Lexi and I were actually connected through an editor at Scholastic who Lexi had met because of a book called You Should See Me in a Crown that was selected by Reese's Book Club.
Yeah, at that time I had just finished up Little Fires Everywhere, and Reese just knew that I was really passionate about the literature world as well. So I did an event for Reese's Book Club for specifically the book You Should See Me in a Crown, and the book editor of that specific book, Meyer Marlette, is also just a book editor at Scholastic. And so through having conversations with her, I expressed that I would like to write my own book one day. And so I pitched her kind of like an idea. We started talking about it. And then I decided that since this was my first time writing, that maybe it would be better just to also have someone else with me along the process. And so I met with a couple of different authors, but as soon as I met Ashley, we immediately connected. And then from then on, we started working.
Fantastic. So I would love to know a little bit more about the way in which you have worked together to craft this new novel, Louder Than Words. What have been kind of the nuts and bolts of this collaboration? Are you trading back and forth, or are you sitting side by side, writing the whole thing together the whole way? I mean, partnerships like this work in all kinds of different ways. How is your partnership working?
So this is Ashley again. So the way that it worked was because I came into the project after the idea was sort of already in process, Lexi and I sort of brainstormed together to, like, deepen the story, to further develop the characters, and then to put together an outline. So we worked on that outline together along with our editor, Maya Marlette. And once we sort of had a very solid understanding of what the story was going to be, we sort of went off and divided up the story in the way that made the most sense as far as the writing part of it went. And then during the editorial process, we sort of did trade pages back and forth. Like, I would read what Lexi had written, she would read what I had written, and then we would take Maya's notes and sort of incorporate those to make sure that the story was flowing and that even though two different people were writing it, it still felt very cohesive.
Mm. I have to say, having read this wonderful novel, that I would never guess that it was written in that fashion. I mean, there is absolutely no sense of kind of trading back and forth between different voices. It really has a beautiful cohesiveness, and I really appreciate the story so much. At the heart of it is a young woman by the name of Jordan, who is a student at Edgewood High, having transferred there from a private school, Hartwell Academy, having been expelled there under very unfair circumstances. And so here she is in this brand new public school, I mean, new to her, trying to kind of find her way. At one point, very early on, as we kind of follow her inner thoughts, there's kind of an intriguing turn of phrase about fitting in versus blending in. And I really love that notion. I wonder what, for you who wrote those words, what that kind of means for you, and in a sense, how that is a part of the story of Jordan, fitting in versus blending in.
Yeah. I feel like specifically, well, with me personally, I just got out of high school not too long ago, and I can really relate to just Jordan's story and her journey in general. When writing this book and just coming up with the concept, I was thinking about me and my peers, and I was thinking about specifically how when I was growing up, I feel like I tried to excel in every area and in every shape or form. I tried to be perfect. I tried to be everyone's friend. I tried to fit in all areas. And I think that sometimes stories like this, where you see just a very realistic, where you see it just being very realistic, where young kids can relate to it, because at the end of the day, like, you don't always fit in, and that's okay. You don't always get everything perfect. And I think that for the overachievers, the younger people that really put a lot of pressure on themselves to excel in every way, shape, or form, it's important to read stories like this and to see stories like this where you know that, like, your mistakes don't define you. Other people's perception of you doesn't define you, and so on. But I think with Jordan, at the end of the day, you see a young girl who has made mistakes before, and she's just trying to escape, and she's trying to step out and have this redemption journey, redemption arc, that doesn't always look 100% perfect sometimes.
Right.
So, yeah, it's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that's especially compelling about the book is that Jordan and some of her closest friends are not perfect, and yet at least most of them are good people with good hearts, with the best of intentions, who occasionally make mistakes, or those good intentions kind of lead them to maybe do things that aren't exactly what they perhaps should have done in retrospect.
Yeah.
I mean, and I really do appreciate that. I want you to talk for a moment about the kind of activist heart that is part of Jordan and some of her closest friends as well, because of course that's at the heart of this too, is what it means for somebody this age to stand up for themselves for things that they believe, especially when they think something wrong has been done.
So I think that when it comes to kids today and activism, I feel like Generation Z is just like super, I don't know, I really admire them. I'm a little bit older than Lexi and the intended audience for this novel. And I feel like while my generation definitely had a voice and activism was important to us, and, you know, we started things like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, and Me Too was really big for as far as, like, you know, online activism and that kind of thing. I think that's where it sort of started, and Gen Z has just taken it to a whole nother level. They are so passionate and so, like, I don't know, boots on the ground, just willing to really speak out for anything that they believe in. And so I think that was a really important part of the story for us, in that the kids who tend to end up making the biggest differences, I think, in their schools and in their communities are also kids who really are not afraid to speak up for what they believe in. And because we knew this was a story that was all about sort of second chances and making, I guess, decisions that really made an impact, we knew that we wanted her group of friends to also have that dual identity of being sort of like these regular kids who have good hearts, but then also having that activism element of it. And I think bringing the art as activism into it as well was a big part of telling the story, because it's a big part of our society right now. It's just kind of how, in addition to, I think, social media, I think art is also just like, it has always historically been a part of activism, and I think that continues to be the case now.
Right. Well, at the heart of the kind of the big issue or concern that kind of engulfs Jordan and others is a podcast that is done by somebody at Edgewood High, a podcast called Tomcat Tea, and it seems relatively harmless, but becomes less and less harmless as time goes on, as it begins exposing all kinds of sometimes terrible secrets in various students' lives, ruining their reputations and so on. And it's kind of interesting to think about. Of course, one of the things about podcasts is pretty much anybody can do them, and that accessibility and the fact that most podcasts are not carefully curated means that all kinds of things can happen, all kinds of things can be said, and one can easily imagine a scenario in which a student-created podcast becomes something so destructive. And of course, Jordan wants to try to do something about that.
Yes, absolutely. This is Ashley again. I think I think that when it comes to podcasts, they're becoming more and more popular. And so that's another sort of element in addition to the art and the social media elements of the story. We really wanted to include that podcast because, I don't know, like, I think a lot of podcasts nowadays, they have they're so self-interested, I guess. The hosts are often just talking about things that are important to them and looking for an audience who also wants to hear about that, whatever they're talking about. So I feel like in a situation like this, when it comes to high school, finding that audience is very easy because everyone loves gossip. Mm. But it can very easily turn dark, and that's what you see happen in the story.
Right, and of course, it's so interesting to follow Jordan in her efforts to try to kind of do something about this. As I read your book, one of the things that really struck me was that it felt so cinematic, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. I could just so easily imagine this story up on a screen. Is that something either of you thought about? I wonder, Lexi, you come to this as someone whose resume is mostly that of an actor. I mean, did you write this with that possibility in mind at all?
Yes. When writing or just creating like all of like any of the projects that I have my own production company as well. And so in terms of whether it is writing a book or creating a film or even just what I attach myself to as an actor, I love things that kind of feel very coming of age, cinematic, that make you feel good, and that also make you feel seen and heard. And I think that specifically with Louder Than Words while writing, it was just kind of like, I think it was something that I was subconsciously doing, but I was almost writing as if I could also see this as a film or as a series. I love, my favorite books to read are books where you can immerse yourself so deeply in the experience that you see it all playing out in your mind as you're reading. And so I just wanted readers to get that same kind of feel when they were reading it. And I'm glad that it kind of translates like that, because later on that would be a hope. We would love to see this then kind of the story be told in a more cinematic way on the big screen.
Right. Last question. This first collaboration obviously worked out wonderfully well. Do you foresee writing other books together?
I love that.
Yeah. You never know. There's always a possibility. I'm a big collaborator. Several of my other novels are collaborative novels, so it's definitely something I enjoy doing. I had a great experience with Lexi writing this novel, so super open to the possibility.
Hmm. The book, again, is Louder Than Words, published by Scholastic. The co-authors, Ashley Woodfolk and Lexi Underwood. Congrats to both of you, and thank you for being my morning show guests. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the Morning Show podcast, a look back at Hurricane Katrina with New Orleans journalist Jed Horn and his amazing book called Breach of Faith. On Sunday, a look at the op-ed page of the New York Times with its longtime art director. On Monday, no morning show broadcast because of the Labor Day holiday. Our studios will be closed, but from the archives, I'll be playing an interview from 2008 with the author of a book called Laboratories of Faith, examining some of the ways in which the occult became a very, very significant part of French life and culture in the 19th century. On Tuesday, back to live programming, and Dr. Lynn Akey, the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, will be my guest. On Wednesday, we'll be talking with representatives of the Kenosha Public Library about a new program aimed at babies and toddlers. And next Thursday, Ashley Hansen, Vice President for Enrollment at Carthage, takes us through the incredibly daunting and challenging process of recruiting college and university students in this day and age. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Look for the Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. We will have rain for much of the morning, possibly a bit of rain this afternoon as well, headed for a high of 83 degrees. Overnight, skies become partly cloudy with a low of 59. Tomorrow, Saturday, should be sunny with a high of 83 degrees. On Sunday and Monday, sunny and temperatures in the 70s. This is WGTD HD Kenosha.